6 o'clock. Let's go ahead and start with the pre-council meeting. Let's try to end both sessions 5 minutes before, so we can take a short break before we start promptly at 7. That should be our target.
Very good. We have two topics to cover tonight. The first is traffic calming. The second is a memo you've received about council memos, the memos about memo. So I think you'll find that interesting. And with that, let's jump in, maybe do 25 minutes on traffic.
Okay, thanks. We'd like to propose some changes to our current calming policy. And with me tonight is Lee White. He's a traffic engineer in our traffic division. Lee's been tasked to do some research in other communities and finding some elements that could be helpful for us. Our current policy was developed and adopted in the late 1990s. At that time, calming was relatively new. There's been some advancements in technology and industry knowledge about calming over the last decade plus. So we'd like to update our approach to try and streamline our current process to better serve our customers with the resources we have. We think the new approach could be more easily managed by staff while better serving those asking for assistance. So with that, I'll turn it over to Lee and get you started.
Thank you. What we have is a traffic calming policy, and what I'd like to propose is a neighborhood traffic management program. So why does the policy need revising? As Dave said, it was written in 1999. We want to reflect some of the changes and streamline the process of what we learned in the past 14 years. Specifically, it can be kind of confusing. There's a few ways to initiate the study. It's unclear when the traffic study is conducted. The engineer solution is presented. Not a lot of back and forth with the neighborhoods. Like, I have a toddler, and he doesn't really like to do anything. It's not his idea. Turns out that's not just a toddler thing. That's everybody, you know. So they like their ideas. And we want to present you guys with one annual report instead of multiple ones. So once again, we want to make it transparent. We want to make the policy data-driven, and we want to be responsive to provide better customer service. We feel that doing that will make our program credible. We'll use some evaluation tools, and once again, one single report. So before we get started, I want to go over some quick engineering jargon. ADT is average daily traffic. That's just the number of cars that drive on the street per day. And you'll hear me say 85th percentile speed, and that's operating speed, or if you recorded 100 car speed and listed them from slowest to fastest, that'd be what the 85th car was driving. That's what we use to set the speed limit. We set the speed limit there. We don't set it for Justin Bieber driving through the neighborhood, because when Justin Bieber's being through his neighborhood, we get calls from guys like Mr. Eastwood here, and he calls up and tells us something to the effect of, there's too many people driving too fast past my house, and they don't like it. And we're charged with, you know, slowing people down through the neighborhoods, creating a more safe neighborhood. So traditionally, what we had done is put things in the street to make people drive over, raised crosswalks, speed humps, speed tables, speed bumps, things people have to drive over, slow down. We can also traditionally put things in the roadway to make people drive around. We're looking at bulb outs and chicanes, medians, something that narrows the roadway down to make people slow down because they don't want to hit things. That's the too fast portion. The too many people portion can be done by half closures or ride-ins, ride-outs, and these are just some traditional traffic calming devices that I wanted to go over before we get going too much. So the foundation of our neighborhood program, the first thing we want to do is reduce collisions and severity of collisions should they occur. That's our home base. That's something we try to achieve every day and improve the neighborhood quality of life and the safety of the residents in there. So to do that, we wanted to integrate our 5 E's. We want to use education and inform the people. We want to use engineering to create good solutions to slow people down. We want to use enforcement as another tool and cooperate with them. The emergency response, make sure they're okay with it. That's kind of a coalition for a task force, kind of what MoDOT is looking at. And then evaluation. We want to make sure what we're doing is good, and we want to make sure that it's working. So that's our foundation. That's our beginning. The next is our goals, where we want to go. And like I said, we wanted to increase transparency so everybody knows where we're at. We want to prioritize the solutions based on data, have a data-driven program, and we want to improve our customer service by being a little more responsive. So I didn't just come up with this program. I had to research some cities, and I looked at what Columbia is and compared us to other similar towns throughout the nation, looked at Eugene, Oregon, our new SEC friends in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and Athens, Georgia, and Ann Arbor, Michigan, felt that they were comparable to us in at least some fashions. What they typically use is the leveled approach to traffic calming. There's three basic levels. Level one is increasing safety. Level two is reducing speed, so that's the too fast portion. And level three is mitigating cut-through traffic, which is the too many people portion. And so level one implementations is kind of the key ingredient here. That's supposed to be quick and visible things that we can do every day to allow the neighborhood to take some ownership in the problem and solution. And we're going to continue the discussion with the neighborhood. So level one here, basic things we do, standard striping, signing, increased enforcement possibly, radar trailers, curb markings, and then a couple other programs that I wanted to include that would be new would be a neighborhood speed watch program and a co-funding of a kid-friendly speed limit signs, which we'll talk about here in a little bit. Levels two and three, too many people driving too fast, that's looks at reducing speed, so we're looking at speed humps, medians that we talked about earlier, and too many people, that includes diverters and extended medians and whatnot through there. So that sounds great. How do we get it started? We want to have a petition for traffic calming. We want to make sure it's a neighborhood problem. So we want to have someone get 10 signatures within the neighborhood and make sure it's an actual problem of the neighborhood to get the program rolling. So we can't just let everybody in. We got to have some basic qualifications, real basic things, paved street in the city of Columbia. We want to be a residential street. We don't want to put speed humps on Providence, and then a minimum ADT of 400 and 85th percentile speed of 33. Or if people really are driving very fast in an area, we want to lower the ADT and allow those people to have a voice too. So here's what my favorite part of the program, and this is the flow chart that's in your packets as you can follow along. I know it's a little hard on the screen here. On the left is the resident's role. On the right is our role. Anybody can follow it. They know exactly where we are in the program. They submit the request. We make sure it's okay, and we implement some level one traffic calming devices right away. And so, you know, radar trailer, curb markings, whatnot. One of those things could possibly be the speed watch program that we talked about earlier. What that is loaning out a radar gun to the citizens to let Mr. Eastwood or whoever it may be see how fast the cars really are driving through the neighborhood. They can keep count. They provide us back the data, and we can see how fast people are really going in that neighborhood. What it can do if people aren't driving that fast is it can create the behavioral change, which is the hardest to make. They can come to that conclusion on their own instead of us telling them that people really aren't driving that fast. It's a low cost to the city. Some of these radar guns can be found pretty cheap, and it's full transparency. They see what's going on. Another thing we came up with was co-funding some of the kid-friendly speed limit signs. As you know, we've been putting these around town the past couple of years, and people really seem to like them. Well, it took me a little while to realize that what they really are is a kind of a combination children at play and speed limit sign. The children at play had never been in the MUTCD sign, but we get calls and requests for that all the time. It's by far the most requested sign, but it doesn't give any guidance to the driver. So what we do is when we combine it with the speed limit sign, is it kind of serves in the same function, and people really like the signs. Like I said, we get those requested all the time. So if we get 10 signatures on that petition, they chip in $13. I feel we can co-fund the speed limit sign and serve our customers very quickly. So as we keep going through there, we've done some basic traffic calming. We've implemented it. We go to the next step, and that's a kind of evaluation tool from the citizens. We're going to see if they like what we've done or not and send them a very basic three-question survey. It could even be done online. We're going to see if they were satisfied with what we did, have them rate it from 1 to 5, and then leave a blank for them to write extemporaneously on how they feel what was going on. If everything's good, then everybody's happy. If not, we'll have them fill out a little more comprehensive survey and really nail down what the problem in the neighborhood is so we can use their input, their opinions, right from the get-go to solve the problem quickly and efficiently. And once again, this can be a web-based form. I made this in Google Docs, actually. So we've gone through level one. Now we're at our level two. We're really looking at putting stuff in the road now. So we've got the petition back from them. The first thing we do is define the area. And so how we do that is we have a few different options for doing that. And this was very, it wasn't very clear in our existing policy. We can look at the houses along the street in question. We can use an entire homeowners association or go per plat and legal description. And if none of those suit, if it's a truly unique situation, we can work with the neighborhood to define an area. So once we have our area defined, we get to the community input meeting. So if you follow the chart there, this arrow goes both ways, back and forth. We develop the test plan and talk with the community. The community works with us to develop the test plan. We're not just telling them what's going to work best. We're working with them to get the best solution for their neighborhood. And that's what I feel is very important with this program. So now we have projects. We're ready to go. Well, how do we know which one's most important? We need to score it. And once again, our main complaint is too many people driving too fast past my house. So you can see the two-thirds of our 100-point scoring system is based on volume and speed. Other things we wanted to look at in it was collisions to see if there's any type of history there. Bicycle routes, if we have lots of bicycles going along there, we still want to make sure people are going slow. Schools, anybody near a school, we want to make sure we're going slow by schools. And then pedestrian generators, anywhere where people will be walking a lot. We're looking at trails, parks, anywhere where people may be going a lot. So how do we score that? We use GIS, and it's really easy. I've put three concentric circles in here. We see what's in within the circles, and we can get our scoring system. This shot here is along Derby Ridge. It's along a bike boulevard. So they get, or bike route, sorry, they get 5 points there. It's within a quarter mile of the school. They get 10 points towards the scoring system there because we want to make sure we're going slower there. In fact, it's so easy, I was able to score a number of projects. As you can see here, this is also in your packet. We have some projects that are older, so we need to contact people and make sure that they still want to participate in the program once this goes through and whatnot. So, as my dad would say, now we got a bunch of projects. We got them prioritized. Who's paying for it? Well, sometimes that's us. And what we want to do is present City Council an annual report with the project, the score, and the cost of the city being the main components there, because some neighborhoods like to contribute financially. We also want to allow for in-kind funding also, and note that within the project too. I've randomly assigned some dollar values and points, and you'll see that in your packet too. So publicly funded, where does that money come from now that we say we're going to pay for some? Well, it comes out of the roadway safety account. It is an account funded by the 2005 transportation tax. It sunsets in 2015. The roadway safety account is also used for signs, delineators, roadway safety projects. We typically spend $30,000 on that in the past. And so now we have projects. We put them in the road. How did they do? We want to make sure we evaluate and send out that one last survey to the people to see how we did. Same survey as before. Are you satisfied with it? Rate it and tell us anything else. With positive evaluations, we can close that project. We have stuff in the road now. So is EMS okay with that? Yes. Yes, they are. We've had a meeting with them. We've talked with them. They seem to be okay with our approach. Scott Batson from Portland, Oregon did a study to see how much speed humps specifically slow down fire engines. And as you can see here, he has a number of different fire engines based on length and wheelbase and weight to see how much they've slowed them down. His results basically said that it slows them down 0 to 9 seconds based on the type of truck, how big they are, and whatnot. And that's for the 22-foot speed bump. That's very similar to our standard for our 20-mile-an-hour one. We also have a 15-mile-an-hour one that had similar results.
When you say bumps, are you including,
including
tables?
I mean humps. Sorry. Sorry.
They could be more gradual tables than the old-fashioned.
Right. The tables are a little more gradual. In summary, we'd like to use the leveled approach to traffic calming. Level one improves safety. Level two reduces speed. And level three is to mitigate the cut-through traffic. We feel that this program will use data to have a data-driven program. The diagrams make the program transparent so anybody can follow along. I think it'll make us be more responsive for our customers, and the performance measures are built in it. The evaluation tools are built in it, so we know if we're doing a good job. Does anybody have any questions?
Yeah, I want to go ahead, Barbara.
Yeah, I had a couple. When you do the study to see what the speed is in the 85 percentile, often just having that machine out there slows down the traffic.
Right.
So do you make an adjustment for that factor?
We typically do not. Some people are savvy enough to know what that is, but these won't be tied with a radar trailer, so they won't feed back the speed. So most people drive over them just as they normally would.
Okay, because I know the department recently did a study of Audubon, but they had the
That was the feedback. That was the police one. Our counters are plate counters out, and so there's no, we don't tell people how fast they're going. They're not as perceptive to that.
And then did you say that we only spend $30,000 a year with that long list?
Well, typically, and that's what I'm getting from our history of our department.
That total fund, I think, is about $75,000 a year for our traffic safety. That was funded in 05. That was per year for 10
years. Just for residential calming?
Typically, the history was $30,000
per year. Yeah, we used them for a while there. We used them for the feedback signs at school zones, and then we actually started putting those in our CIP. Is that correct?
Span wires.
Yeah, span wires. Anything traffic-related, it didn't cover much.
So is it just a matter of getting neighborhoods to apply? Or is it a staff bottleneck or all of the above?
Yeah, a little bit of both, yeah.
Let me bring up a couple of things. And it's about our behavior when we see a police officer, right? I mean, whenever I turn right onto Green Meadows Road from Providence Road, about two or three blocks on Green Meadows Road, a deputy sheriff parks his car about 100 feet off the road,
exactly.
And I'm going to need new brakes because reflexly, I think that's the way we behave. So this gets back to the issue of having the presence of law enforcement. Now, I know that we don't have enough law enforcement officers. I mean, that's, we're 30% understaffed, I assert. But, if a police officer costs $300 a day, $150 a shift, putting a police officer in these high-risk areas, it doesn't take too many tickets to pay for him.
Right.
And I think for many residents of neighborhoods who worry about too much traffic, I think they would welcome that.
Right.
And then I bring out the other issue of just having an empty car there. Do you have any derelict police cars you can park? Because, I guarantee you, it slows me down and probably would slow down a lot of people more effectively than a speed bump, just to see one there.
You're exactly right. I did use that as a level one traffic calming method, was to increase enforcement in certain areas, because you're right, it does slow them down. But over the long haul, people will realize that the cop's no longer there and then once again go back to speeding. So while it may work for a couple months, it's only temporary. But it does make people feel better.
Now, these radar guns, assuming that someone in the neighborhood is willing to use it, I think inherently having somebody standing out there shooting a radar gun, it's going to make people think, what are they doing?
Right.
You know, they'll wonder if there is a plainclothes officer or whatever. Mm-hmm. So these things are configured to, I would think, to show how much traffic is there, what the average speed is, right? Are they configured
right.
for that? So you get your data from an engaged neighborhood association
right.
who wants to secondarily change behavior of cars going through the neighborhood.
Right. It's one thing to speed when no one's looking on the road, but when your neighbor Larry's out there with the radar gun, I think people would tend to
tap their
brakes a little more.
You don't know who that is.
Right. Exactly.
I do want to note that we were presented information that traffic stops are down 50% year over year, which I presume is from staffing challenges that we have. And so that when we're not making these traffic stops, you know, we're not changing the behavior that you're talking about. So that's something for us to consider at our end of the deal, too.
Will we be able to do more projects under this system than we do currently, or will it be about the same?
Yes. I think being able to utilize the level one will be able to serve more customers and quickly, too. Currently, our policy isn't written with that, and I'm a rule follower, so while we can do some of those things, I would like it to be formalized so I can play within the rules and treat everyone fairly to do so.
Lee, I've got a general question about design speeds.
Okay.
Am I right in understanding that the normal way of setting a speed limit for a road is to build the road according to some sort of general concept of what's needed, then to wait and watch the traffic on it and measure how fast it goes, dependent on the way it's designed, and then set the speed limit to be the speed at which the 85th percent fastest car travels?
You are partially correct. During the design, we can utilize curves and grades for a certain speed that's following the AASHTO Green Book. But typically, once it's done, we know about how fast people are going to drive on that road, so we try to utilize those standards, and then afterwards, yes, we do measure people and see about how fast they're going and use the industry standard to help us set it. But we're not going into it blindly. We have some idea when we build them.
Right. And that's still the way, for instance, if new subdivisions are built in Columbia, that's still the way that this would be done. Right. I contrast it with the other approach, which is to say we don't want traffic going any faster than 20 miles an hour in a neighborhood. So let's design the road in the first place to, surely we have data and an ability to, you know, build in curves or, you know, the width of the road and so on, to try to get the 85th percentile speed to be 20 miles an hour in the first place, and then maybe use that process to verify it.
Right. And we try to do that. We have certain standards that the plans are checked to when residential subdivisions come in via private developers. And they're not as they don't have strong standards in them to limit the speeds. But I think all our residential speed limits are 25 as of now. So that's what we're trying to keep people down to.
Okay. So more specifically then, I really like the design of the new program and having this sort of clarity that there are certainly lots of calls for traffic calming, and this looks like a good objective approach to prioritizing those requests. Now, the long spreadsheet at the back, are those actual projects that have been requested and graded?
Yeah, I have graded. Those are projects that have been requested and graded. When we put our counters out, I've also graded each counter. So, like, if you look at Derby Ridge, you might see three locations on there. But that's just based on the location where we put the counters out. So that's why you see a little bit of variation dependent upon the streets. But anywhere I had data, I did try to score them.
So in the hopper right now, there's about 100 projects or so.
Well, and like I said, they broke out a little more because we put multiple counters down.
Okay.
But, yeah, we have over 40 common projects right now.
And do you have an estimate of the cost of all of these?
They're all dependent upon what type of solution we use.
You haven't even really started assessing them yet.
If we use speed humps, they tend to be the most cost-effective and the most effective at slowing down speeds, too. So that's a preferred solution. But as I said, not everybody likes them. Some people might choose different ones, which could increase the cost.
Mm-hmm. So the process for getting a potential traffic calming project on this list would be for the neighborhood to come forward with the petition. That's the starting point.
Right. And then we'll use some level one traffic calming. If they're still not happy, then we'll place our counters down, we'll get the data in, and then we'll work with them to get a solution.
And the level one traffic calming will happen immediately,
yeah.
And there's always going to be budget for that.
Right.
If it needs to go to level two or level three, it'll have to go in the queue for the funding.
Right. And we'll bring that annual report to council each year and have you guys decide which projects can and cannot be funded based on how much money we have. Ms. Hoppe.
A general statement and then a specific question. Two things. A lot of these projects started before we had the reduced residential speed limit, so some of those may not be problems anymore.
Right.
And two, as we see more development, we see more need for traffic calming as cut-through traffic builds up. And three, I was happy to see that you used one of the more modern speed tables in your presentation that are attractive and work well also. So I think neighborhoods need to know that we just don't use the old-fashioned huge hump. And then my specific question is Audubon is listed on the chart, but it's not shown on the map at all. So where is Audubon?
I should have put it on the map. If it's not on there, I apologize.
Okay.
I thought I did.
It's so the chart is right.
Right.
Good.
Yeah.
And I'll follow up specifically.
Right.
Thanks.
I stopped a little short, so our recommended action is if you guys agree with us to authorize us to move forward with the policy revision.
I think you have our consensus on that.
Actually, can I just ask another question on this? Have you looked at the possible problem of implementing a traffic calming project on a particular street and inadvertently redirecting cut-through traffic to the next street along? And have you got a way to kind of handle that?
Yeah, we would look at those with each project mm-hmm. and make sure, because I think some of the streets can be bunched up together,
mm-hmm.
and that's why defining the area can be important, because even though we may put a device on one street, it could have an inadvertent effect on another, and so that's why we need to make the area defined as that whole area, not just that particular street in those situations.
Great. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, guys.
We'll switch gears now, if I can do that myself, and then really want to talk about council memos. So if you think about the tremendous amount of paperwork that you read through every 2 weeks, we try to boil down what it is we're asking for or what has been asked of you into its simplest form. And put it in lay terms, we try not to use jargon, et cetera. And so it's the fundamental who, what, where, why, when, and how much of each item. Now, that said, there has been some interest expressed over the past few years of, especially around fiscal note, about tightening up how we approach council memos. Second page on every council memo, which is that sort of table meant to capture vision-related data elements. Input I've received is that no one really uses that. It does take up quite a bit of paper when we create it, and it's something that staff does spend a little time to do. And so what we want to do today is go through and talk about the council memo, look at what others do, and really cover those two things, as well as this idea of history. So, for example, when you get very complex issues, has been said in the past, it would be helpful to have a timeline of everything we've done or prior actions we've taken on this or at least the council bills that have related to it, at least those numbers. So those are the kind of things that really aren't there now that we'd love to open up and just have a free-for-all about. With that, Tony, would you take us through some of the research you've done?
Okay. I'd like to open by saying that the council memo performs several functions when you think about it. It provides some decision-making tools for you in a capsule form. It's also a way of communicating to anyone who reads it some basic information about the issues that the council deals with every meeting. Finally, it is a unique archival document that really can be of use for historical purposes, both to the general public, to you, and to city staff. In looking at the council memo, we've got this page two situation where there's a form that in some respects duplicates what staff is already telling you in a text version. Paul Harvey used to say, and now the rest of the story, and that seems to be kind of a good phrase for what the graph on the last page of the council memo tends to do. Cities have various ways of dealing with that. My observation from looking at just a few is that some communities have computerized online methods for putting their agendas together. Granicus helps us do that. That's the software package that Sheila uses, and that allows that information to be communicated online. It appears that some of those packages also have opportunities to include elements of legislative history on there. So I don't know if Granicus would let us do that. If council was interested in pursuing that end, we could certainly look at that. But I think the first question is the memo useful for council members? And if it is, in its current form, if you think no changes are needed, that's certainly one way to go. There may be other opportunities for improvement, or it may not really be serving your needs very well at this time. One thing I noticed in looking at the ordinances is that there is a minimum core of information that's required for the fiscal note. Ordinances don't really appear to govern the vision note, but council did adopt a policy a few years ago about including that information, and that was actually a recommendation from the Vision Commission. So if you wanted to make a change there, delete that, change that, that might cause you to update your policy on that. Legislative history, again, I think is extremely useful both for you and for the average person who is looking at that, especially when items go on for many months, many years, when they're very complex. I think it's very helpful to be able to just look at those milestones that got council to where it is in that decision-making process. I'm open to your questions and your thoughts.
Well, I'll start by saying that I think the memo is extremely helpful. I mean, there are some of these ordinances, resolutions that we have to go through every page. There are others where there are 200-page legal documents that we're not going to read. And the executive summary memo is extremely important. I think whether you deal with legislative history, I've never really ever been quite satisfied with the searchability of our data. In other words, you know, to be able, we did a Richland Road rezoning 3 years ago. So it's hard to find that. There's really not, in my mind, a good way to enter that database and to find the minutes of that meeting or the memo of that meeting. So for me, what would be more important than having it listed here is the ability to have searchable information. Now, maybe that's already there, but maybe you know, I just need to be taught how to do that, or any other rezoning, or any other issue. It's just hard for me to get into our database right now and to go back. And I'm not sure what meeting it was. You know, I have to guess. I have to go through meeting by meeting and look at the agendas. And I just ought to be able to search Richland Road rezoning and come up with it.
I think there's no question that the process is cumbersome. Even some of the council members that have been here a while who have a little bit of historical perspective go through the same, have the same problem, and that is you have to do a search of the agendas and so on, and then you have to move to the meetings themselves, and you know, it takes a while. And I can even imagine that it's even more cumbersome for the public to do this, who doesn't even have that context. So that certainly would be a major improvement. I think that the story here is really one of history is important, the history timeline is important, but it's really about context, because that's what provides you with the stuff, not only the council, but also the public, in terms of how decisions are made and how the council shapes those decisions and policies. So it would be useful to have some historical perspective. I think that provides the context by which the current decisions are made, and that would be very valuable to me. So I think the mayor's suggestion about searchability and this business about including context is very important. With regard to this fiscal and vision note stuff, I can remember, I guess I might have even been a part of that, asking for some of this information. But I've always been a little bit uncomfortable with it, and people have criticized it, because usually what happens when we talk about costs, almost always the costs are zero because they're limited to the fiscal year issues. And we all know that there are going to be costs associated down the road, maybe the following year, and it's very difficult to put a number on that kind of cost. But even some sort of qualified best guess as to what we're in for beyond just the fiscal year, I think, would be important. That's the kind of information I think that folks were looking for when we were talking about fiscal notes.
That one, if I might just interject, that one has probably created the most internal confusion. If you think about fiscal note, think about the type of items we have on the agenda. Sometimes we are setting a date of a hearing. Well, what does that really cost, right? Well, nothing, right? But what are we talking about? You know, so the bigger question that I hear a lot is, we know setting the date of a hearing isn't really an incremental cost of any kind, but what are you proposing to buy? What are you proposing to spend? And so some folks have wanted to see that number in some context for that, even though we're just setting the date of hearing. So that's one example where I think there's been folks have felt like they didn't have all the information by the time they got there.
And just in addition, one thing that is very valuable, I think, and that was the appearance of statements in these notes in terms of the visioning documents, I'm assuming that eventually there will be some of the comprehensive plan ideas in here that are going to guide policy as well. That's really real useful information. Maybe that should be provided as well in terms of the historical context of whatever policy decision we're considering.
I agree with both Mr. Scala and the mayor on their points. So I think in fiscal we're looking for not only the short term but the long term costs to the city. And that may vary for each item. But that's the end objective. I think the fiscal narrative is more valuable than the box, and the box is a duplication, so I'd be totally comfortable in eliminating the box. And the vision statement, I think that's very valuable, because the visioning process was not only for the city but for the community. And so even though we're doing a comprehensive plan, that is subsumed in the visioning process. It doesn't replace it. So I think it's good for council and the public and staff to keep an eye on what were the goals and the outcome of the visioning process. And otherwise, I find it very valuable. I like the historic, maybe if there's an important historic information to do a link or something like that, because it is hard to find the relevant information that we need that may not be in there. But I would say that those staff reports are the most valuable thing. I go to those first, then read things, then I go back to them again. And I'm sure that really helps the public also.
Yeah, Ms. Happy's comments made me think about one other additional issue, and that is she mentioned things about, like, links. And, for example, we're going to be discussing some of the issues around the Parkside development tonight. And there are links that would be helpful. I mean, some of us can get to it at one point or another, but something like the Bonne Femme Watershed Plan. When we're talking about particular issues that come before us and in the midst of all of this discussion, it would be real helpful to me that to have a link that I could go to access that document without spending a lot of time trying to find it. Some are easier to find than others.
Challenge is, of course, that we're assuming that whoever's responsible for that knows that that exists.
That's
and
true.
That
and they should.
You have the historical background true. To know that it should be there, but when we're asking clerical worker to do that, it's tough. And I think we also understand that the cost analysis is not a comprehensive cost analysis, because if you buy two buses, what's the cost? You know, I mean, depreciated cost, repair, maintenance, I mean, and what's the benefit? So, I mean, there's really a comprehensive financial analysis and includes the return on that investment, too, the return on the bus. So, I mean, I think what we're looking for, the check you're writing, and the rest of it, we don't expect, you don't have the staff to perform a comprehensive cost-benefit analysis on each bus that we buy.
One of the most confusing things I find is the order in which different elements of the packet are put together, and often an inconsistency in that. For me, this is the page that I always look for first, with the City of Columbia logo and the executive summary discussion and the fiscal and vision impact. I think it would be helpful if that was either right at the front.
First page.
Yeah. That's
yeah.
Great.
Sometimes it's the next to the last
written
page.
In an understandable language.
That's
and
right,
it kind of. And then I think a table of contents, if there are a lot of different components, where the bill language itself is, if there's evidence of informing the public and public input in some kind of consistent order. I like the vision note, and I think it should stay. And if the staff feel that a strategic plan note is relevant as well, then I would support that as well. I don't think enormous amounts of staff effort should go into that, but I think it's a good reminder. As a matter of fact, on a bill coming up today, I'm going to discuss the vision impact note and whether that was completely or adequately done. And I think that's fine if it just prompts an appropriate conversation and tying the particular piece of legislation we're looking at to the vision. And yes, historical information would be very helpful. It's often here, but there'll be sort of some P and Z, transcription in there in an apparently random place in the packet. So again, having a sort of a systematic, consistent order for the different elements would be really helpful for me.
As an example, the searchability issue, we're dealing with the sale of land at the Souter Industrial Park is one of the items. And I really don't have any way of going back to when that land was purchased and the history of it. And now this may be very difficult to do because you've got data stored in different formats. But it would have been nice to be able to say, to do a search of Souter Industrial Park throughout the whole minutes database and to go back and find out, you know, when that was conceived and what the thinking was at the time, and the whole, that would be one way of coming up with a history, is to make it searchable. Now, I don't know if that's, I know it's always possible, but, you know, we don't have that at this time.
Well, there is, of course, the problem that we have that we our wish list might include lots of stuff, and that means lots of work for you, right? I mean, to the extent to which I think these are great ideas, these ideas about the table of contents and all the rest of it, and how I go about taking a look at this stuff and the process by which I review this material, an additional point would be that would be helpful, and it often appears, is some sort of an executive summary that gives you an idea of what the body of the document contains. Because although I will typically read the entire document, I don't reread it just before the council meeting, and I would rather rely on some sort of executive summary that will remind me what it was that I may have read, and the table of contents can help us get to that particular point if there's something that I want to refresh my memory on.
As an example of creating a searchable database, you could take one of your care employees for a summertime job to go through minutes and simply copy minutes into Word and put them in one file. And that way you bring up the file and you can do a you know, whatever searchable file it would be, but you just go through this meeting and put it in one file, and that would be, you know, one job for one of the care employees that we hire. That's not highly technical. It takes time, but that's an example of a way you could produce a database that we all could search Souter Industrial Park and come up with the historical perspective.
You know, I don't know if this is an easy fix either. But since we're just brainstorming with some of these ideas, it was always a little bit difficult to interpret what REP such and such was. It would be helpful to just have a term in there, and that might even help the searchability of
key
it.
Key almost.
Yeah, something. I mean, because. If I'm referring some report to someone else, I have to make sure that I use those keys to tell somebody else what that report is, but it doesn't appear that way. They're usually just REP such and such with a number rather than any indication of what the content is.
Well, I think what you've heard is the memos are very important, and they really serve as a starting point, and sometimes they end up as a finishing point. As I said before, if there's a 200-page legal contract, Barbara may be the only one who reads it. I know she reads it because she's very diligent.
Not at all.
Well,
not
but
all.
Let me, if I may, I think there are two comments left, and then I have a couple things to make sure we.
I think I just want to kind of add, and I know we've had this discussion several years ago relating to the vision and the impact statement. One of the goals of the visioning process was we were going to kind of keep a grade card of what we do. So while the vision impact is important to see, and I like to make reference to what, you know, where in that document it, we're really, you know, referencing to, we don't ever at the end of a fiscal year go and say, here's what we have done, or just, you know, make mention of, you know, what accomplishments we've made towards our visioning impact as well as our strategic plan. Because if we're going to set priorities in our strategic plan, even we need to see at the end of the fiscal year that we've accomplished whatever priorities we set for that year.
And that's where my brain goes. I think you might have more value if we really take a look at the vision and what's been done and give you a sort of comprehensive report out on it. That's about as much effort as it takes us to fill out this box for every item that we do. Because quite honestly, not everything is related to the vision. Some of it's just housekeeping work, right? And but it's on there. We fill it up. So I'd almost, if I could trade it, I would love to do that. Take that off and do an annual report versus the box.
I'm okay with dropping the box. I mean, I don't get it. The memos are helpful. The narrative's helpful for sure. Like everybody said, I wouldn't mind seeing while we're making wish lists P&Z staff reports. Would be helpful because when I read the minutes, they'll often say, hey, that was a great report. You summed it all up. Let's vote. And it's like, and I know they're handy. You can go to the agenda and click the link and find them. But I have trouble because I'm reading too many contracts, apparently, getting through everything without having to look up a whole lot else stuff either.
Okay.
Or at least the link to the minutes, right? Some place you could go.
Let me sum up what I've heard and make sure there's consensus on it, if we can, just in the interest of time. And let me stress, we as staff are very appreciative of your comments. We're profoundly aware that this is the historic record of what you do, and we want it to be useful and meaningful for posterity as well. So what I've heard is we really like the memo. We'd like it to move first in the list of item elements and make it searchable in a better way than we have now. Minutes and agenda items, it sounds like. Keep the vision impact language where it's first mentioned in the language portion, but taking the box off is something that seems to have support. Fiscal impact, clarity there is what check are you writing? I think obviously we have the guidance from the ordinance now, but what check are we writing, and maybe some element of the big picture if there is one on that particular item. And then this idea of a table of contents, maybe at least if the memo comes first, we could say what's attached. So there'll always be an there will oftentimes be an ordinance and then any other attachments, which may include P&Z minutes or other past documents. And then some effort at history, and maybe with page numbers, you know, in the whole attachment where to find it. And then perhaps a key to help interpret what our language shorthand is for REPs versus O versus R. Did I capture most of the?
Yeah. Okay.
I think what we'll do is mock that up for you and let you see it before we start to change anything. And then
I was going to mention, I do like the format. It's nice and pleasant and readable, so don't change it too much on the format.
We're certainly shooting for that, so let's.
Okay, shall we take a break and start promptly at 7?
That'll work.